Welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. My name is Nate Silver. Full disclosure, our normal host, Jody, and our normal producer, Galen, are both out today, so this is going to be an interesting episode.
Welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. My name is Micah Cohen. First up, full disclosure, our normal host Jody and our normal producer Galen are both out today, so I think this is going to be a pretty interesting and or subpar episode. Second.
Interesting is the word. Okay. That's a term that my partner uses when some food tastes like crap. He's like, oh, this is interesting.
That's so polite and Midwestern of it.
Yeah, that is.
Second, before we introduce the normal gang and those voices you just heard, I wanted to congratulate perhaps the greatest team in the NFL history.
Oh, my God.
And their wonderful, patient fans, the Philadelphia Eagles, who won the Super Bowl last night. Any Super Bowl reactions, guys?
I watched the second half.
And there you have
That's my reaction.
If you knew about the election last year, there was that 1% of Americans who liked both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. I'm that way with the Eagles and the Patriots. I actually kind of like both teams. I'm not really sure why, but like I was going to be happy either way.
Philadelphia and Boston are basically the same city.
No, Philadelphia is better than Boston.
Way better. Okay, so let's do the official introductions now. Nate, you just did a lot of talking. People know who you are.
Okay.
Woo!
Claire Malone.
Hi.
Thank you.
I'm a senior politics writer at 538.com.
Jody normally gives the titles.
Yeah, but whatever.
And another senior politics writer, Harry Enten. Harry, welcome.
I want to point out that even though the Eagles won, the highest rating in any market was actually in Buffalo. More people tuned in, more households tuned in that city than any other.
Not much else to do in Buffalo. Stare at the snow and the TV.
Shots fired. Jeez.
Buffalo, by the way.
Cleveland, want to talk.
The only two cursed sports cities anymore, because like Philadelphia, the Eagles won, the Cubs won. The Royals won,
it's
right?
Cleveland.
Buffalo.
Cleveland, the Cavaliers won.
Yeah, it's not Cleveland.
I mean,
so the Indians almost won. The Cavaliers did win. So it's only Buffalo and Washington, but no one really cares about Washington. And Toronto, which no one also cares about. So only Buffalo really is like the only sympathetic.
So Washington and Toronto, as in the District of Columbia, which won a Super Bowl, you know, back in 1992, like and Toronto,
yeah,
like which won a World Series right around
Caps,
the same time.
Man, if you're not a hockey guy, you know, the Caps have been pretty cursed, and like the Nats have been pretty cursed. I mean, Washington, D.C. is actually pretty cursed.
I don't buy that at all.
But this is, I mean, if you guys were being more objective, if you looked at the data. No, like, they would be considered cursed, except no one likes D.C., so therefore no one really cares.
Well, that's a factor. You know, how much people care. Like, if Philadelphia is a lovable, important city.
Basically the same as Boston.
But more likable and pleasant.
Less snow.
All right, before we get to the actual show today, we have some news. Some unpleasant news, in fact. Harry, I'm going to turn it over to you.
So, folks, this is difficult already. I don't think I'm going to get through it. This is going to be the last time that I'm going to be appearing on this program as a regular member of the podcast crew. That is because today is my final day at 538. There will be news about where my next adventure takes me eventually. But I just wanted to say thank you for listening and putting up with this very nasally voice. I will say that each of these people who are sitting around me and Jody, who's not actually sitting around me, I get along great with all of them. And that is the hardest part of all of this, is saying goodbye to all of these people who I care so deeply about and I hope in turn care about me. Some of you probably know that back in September of 2015 was a very difficult time for me. And my mother tells this story to me, and I may butcher it a little bit. But I remember the entire office came to something that wasn't very, very easy for me. Still isn't. And I remember Nate was introduced to my mother to my aunt. And my mom said, oh, this is Harry's boss. And Nate corrected her and said that, no, I'm Harry's friend. And I think that says everything that needs to be said around here is that we're all friends here. And I hope that we'll be able to continue to do so even as I depart. That's basically all I have to say.
Well,
Harry,
it's not goodbye, Harry. It's bon voyage. I just want to point out, Harry helped build this site into what it is today. It would not be what it is today without Harry. He is on to very exciting things which we'll have more detail on Tuesday, and we're all going to keep in touch. So thank you, Harry.
Thank you.
I think actually we're going to have a special guest call in here in a second.
Are you there, God? It's me, Margaret.
This is me. I'm in a cabin in Montana. Am I live on the pre-taped podcast?
Are you prospecting for gold?
All the gold's gone. But there's plenty of snow.
Oh, I'm jealous. I am so jealous. Jody, are you going to FedEx some back for me? Put it on ice.
I'll put some snow in my bag for you. Look, I'll let you get on with the show, but I did want to call in even though I'm on vacation and just send my regards to Harry. And I just want to say, and this is a slightly earnest thing for me, which is tough, as you know. But I'm going to miss Harry a lot on the podcast, but I'm mostly going to miss him just around the office. Harry is,
here.
As I'm sure listeners can imagine, a very unique coworker. And I think the sort of day-to-day life at 538 is going to be different in addition to our podcast. And I don't know if listeners caught that last week I did not use the WizKid intro, but this feels like it's probably way past due, but this feels like a very good time to retire the WizKid moniker. So Harry, carry on, and thanks for everything, man.
Thanks, Jody.
All right, guys. Have a great show.
Okay, now to the real business of the show, our first segment. First up, does the Nunes memo matter? That's our big question here.
Nunes?
No, it's not. It's not Spanish.
The notorious Mr. N.
It's not Spanish.
So after a lot of buildup, the so-called Nunes memo came out on Friday. This is named for the chairman of the House Intel Committee, Devin Nunes. Trump supporters kind of framed it as vindicating Trump and showing that the investigation into whether his campaign colluded with Russia during the 2016 election or whether there was obstruction of justice was a partisan, quote, witch hunt. Most non-Trump loyal observers called the whole thing a nothing burger and painted the memo as an effort to undermine confidence in Special Counsel Robert Mueller and the FBI.
Mueller.
Jeez. Nunes Mueller. Okay, so what was all this about? What does the memo show? And is this smoke? Is it fire? Do we care? Nate?
I mean, out of all the stupid news cycles, and I know how high the bar is, like this one is near the top. I mean, look, there are some, I think, moderately interesting claims made in the Nunes memo. I don't know if you guys have ever followed the debate over climate science, but one thing that happens is that people will hone in on some very specific point and make like halfway true claims about that point and kind of really, really intentionally kind of miss the big picture, the kind of volume of evidence overall. I'm not saying that the Russia investigation is anywhere near as certain as climate science. I think it's a lot more ambiguous, frankly. But this is not a very persuasive refutation of the core of it, where I guess the claims they're making are, number one, the Steele dossier was an important part of the reason to get a FISA warrant against Carter Page.
It paints it as central, basically.
As central. Or not the memo itself, but maybe the facts within the memo, to which I'm like, so what, right? Like, what if all of that is true?
Right.
And also people are saying that other evidence was used in order to attain.
The memo claims that the FBI did not tell the FISA judge that the dossier had sort of partisan origins, basically, right? And so the FBI should have disclosed that, and therefore, I don't know, they wouldn't have gotten the warrant or something against Page, who is just like one figure in all this.
So the claim is that the origin was from a DNC-funded effort to collect opposition research on Trump. I mean, a lot of the reporting you'll see in a newspaper or anywhere comes from sources that, to varying degrees, have self-incentives or dubious incentives. And the question is, you vet this
But we should say here that this is one of the points that the Democrats say has been mischaracterized in this memo. So I'm reading from a statement from Adam Schiff, who says, this is in response to the memo, he says, the majority suggests that the FBI failed to alert the court as to Mr. Steele's potential political motivations or the political motivations of those who hired him, but this is not accurate. So this is a point that's under dispute between the Democrats and Nunes.
By the way, there's no actual claim that the claims in the Steele memo are wrong.
They're wrong, right.
You know, there's no real indication as to why Carter Page is a very important actor in all this anyway. So it's like just on point, like grant every claim and even exaggerate it by 30%, like concede every claim. It doesn't really move the needle as far as like the Russian investigation overall in either direction. So to me, the fact that like you have Trump or Devin Nunes or whomever else, not all Republicans by any means, but kind of standing up and saying, oh, it's a huge deal. Like, that just shows how low the threshold is in this age of, like, partisan hackery, frankly. Like, you don't even need halfway persuasive arguments.
Yeah.
Even, like, an eighth of the way to being persuasive, if you are looking for things to confirm your priors, will suffice.
You know, when people say this is a nothing burger, nothing in here materially moves the investigation forward. Fine, all taken. But the fact that this memo was declassified and such a hoopla came of it is a something burger. I mean, if you read between the lines, the idea that the president let this memo come out sort of seems to insinuate that people are hoping to discredit the investigation of Mueller, ultimately, right? Taking away any of the facts of this memo, the fact of its release and the hoopla stirred up over it, the fact that Paul Ryan is on board with this, that says something about how certain Republicans view and are sort of going to bat for Trump if he wanted to make a move to fire Rosenstein and put someone in place who would then be willing to fire Mueller, potentially.
Yeah, I think that that's right. I think that more than perhaps any other issue, the way that Republicans in Congress have reacted to the Russian investigation shows how loyal they are to the President of the United States and that he is a member of their particular party at this particular time. That's especially the case on the House side. I think the Senate might be a different ballgame altogether. I don't think that there was anything in this memo that makes me think that this was a game changer. There's going to perhaps be the release of the minority report. We'll see if that does, in fact, get released. But overall, I didn't read this and think, oh, my God, they got it dead to rights either one way or another. Yeah. It kind of reminded me, you know, of sort of one of these elementary Law and Order episodes whereby, you know, oh, you got it from the fruit of the poisonous tree, but there may, in fact, have been other ways that they would have gotten Carter Page. So I just didn't see this as much of anything. I think that we're just so dire for news in some sense. The last month has kind of been quiet in the Trumpian sense. And I think that there was a lot of news built up about this and a lot of Twitter activity from fans of the president. And that was why this became such a big deal, even though I don't particularly view it as one.
So to Claire's point, though, did we learn anything by the reaction to the memo by Republicans, by Democrats, by the media? Did you guys find any of that interesting?
I think it'll be interesting once. I don't really care what people on Fox say, but I care what their viewers will ingest over the next 6 months. And the fact that if you're a person prone to disbelieving government institutions, which, by the way, on the left and right, like, people don't like the FBI, right? Like, there was some funny cartoon about how, like, aging hippies forced to, like, root for FBI. You know, like, it's a weird, like, out of whack thing. But I think the fact that also contained in the memo is a sort of an insinuation that there was a conspiracy within the FBI to prevent Trump from becoming president, which is already something that's out there lurking on right-leaning conspiracy theory internet. Wherever people get their conspiracy theories from, many sources these days. I am bothered by the fact that, frankly, the memo was declassified, and declassified under the objections of the FBI, who said they didn't have time enough to review it, that the Republicans prevented simultaneous release of the Democrats.
The rebuttal.
It just sort of seems like willful disinformation going out to the public with the stamp of the United States Congress on it. And I think that's a problem.
No, and I mean, look, let's try to lose some of the pretense here. This is 538 after all. I mean, that it seems like that is what
it's disinformation.
Yes.
And, you know, John McCain had a quote about this, which I will not say word for word, but he was basically like, the only government that this helps is Putin's.
Yeah.
And I take his point, which is that it's pretty striking that this came out.
The release is something. But there was McCain, a few other Republicans on the Sunday shows
Trey Gowdy, who's announced he's retiring. I mean, I'm not sure how to count anymore these Republicans who say they're retiring, who are clearly often quite willing to speak out against Trump.
Yeah.
It's tricky. I wish we had some type of, like, tracker of, like, GOP sentiment toward Trump on issues like these.
On non-policy issues.
I don't think you saw, I don't watch the Sunday shows usually. Sorry, Sunday shows. Especially on Super Bowl Sunday. But from my understanding, there were not a whole lot of people kind of going on eagerly and kind of vigorously defending the memo.
Right.
Paul Ryan is an interesting case study. He's also a guy who's rumored to be retiring, by the way, but has been more supportive. I mean, this is not insignificant, but you didn't have, like, a full-throated defense of it.
All right, but let's switch from elected officials to voters. Does anybody, Harry, you want to start, like, hazard a guess as how to the public will respond?
I will guess that it will break down along partisan lines. The Russia investigation, as we
Hashtag analysis.
Hashtag analysis.
That was an Axios-sized nugget.
There it is, baby.
Are you going to Axios, Harry?
That's right.
Ooh, let's float for the next day or so. Let's float conspiracies about where Harry's going.
Look, the Russia investigation, with perhaps the exception of the Jim Comey firing, the polling really hasn't tended to move much as new news has broken about it. When they do ask about it, it tends to break along partisan lines. Based upon the reaction of the people around this table, that this is not really a big deal in the general sense of what we've learned from the memo, perhaps the release being something separate, the action taken being to release it. I think that that's where the general guess is that this is not going to move things very, very much. I mean, keep in mind this much. We've said, you know, oh my God, the president's approval rating is moving, and it's that is 3 points, and that's a huge move in this administration. So no, I don't think that this is going to change things very particularly much. But of course, we've been surprised before on this podcast.
Anybody want to disagree with that?
Yeah, I think this is this kind of stupid shit that no one really cares about. I mean, again, it's catered to partisans, and the way it could matter more is if Trump decides, oh, now that kind of all the people I'm listening to on Fox and Friends and whatever are telling me this is all a sham, this investigation, if he were to fire Rosenstein or whatever else. I mean, the fact that his approval ratings did drop so much after the Comey firing, not so much, but from like 40 to 37,
yeah,
right? It's a single biggest move you see on the chart in his first year in office. That suggests that he's not totally immune from consequences. But again, I go back to the fact that, like, look, what really kind of is going to shape public opinion? It's when someone gets fired, when someone gets pardoned, or when Mueller comes back with a finding in either direction.
I don't think public opinion matters so much in this story. It's a Washington story that matters very much because it could potentially be a part of a chain of events that could lead to someone firing people at the FBI, at the DOJ, and that leading to Mueller being fired. Because I think we all have recognized that the president has an ability of magical thinking where he can recreate a memory of an event, and this memo helps create an alternate history of what happened with the investigation. And I think it's something that Trump can now point to. And this is a Washington story that matters because it matters to Trump. And it plays into the feedback loop of what Trump wants out of the investigation.
So let's end on that question. With politics kind of so polarized and balkanized now, are we going to see more of these sort of like niche-based scandals? I mean, like during the campaign, during the Democratic primary, I remember there were a few examples of kind of like Sanders supporters had these like hobby horse scandals that they kept pointing to that were sort of nothing burgers. But is this like a new thing? And if they don't move public opinion overall, do they matter, or should we ignore them? Or
2008, that Obama-Clinton primary, people forget how nasty that was.
Oh, right? Yeah.
Right.
Really, and lots of really kind of minor stories that kind of would blow up into. I mean, so it all feels kind of familiar. I mean, I don't know. I guess, like, there are a lot of smart people who I think were saying, hey, the release of this memo really does indicate it's a new phase of partisanship, or it's a new low that's been achieved. I'm not sure I buy that, because it doesn't seem to me as though there was that much in the memo that actually hadn't been reported already, right? If Trump were really willing to, like, compromise national security goals.
Well, we went against the explicit recommendation of the FBI.
Okay, that's true. Yeah. To go to war with the FBI, and I think, you know,
that's something.
I think to go to war with the FBI is probably pretty risky. You know, the FBI has lots of ways to make you unhappy if you go to war with it. The consequence might be that this is going to increase the degree of risk for Trump down the line, right? And then it's not just a matter of karma, but that, like, kind of turning the intelligence agencies, being in a hostile situation with them when they know a lot about a lot of things, is probably unwise.
Who watches The Watchmen?
That's a perfect place to leave it. We're going to talk about to what extent Trump has taken over the Republican Party in a second. But first, through the magic of technology, here's Jody with a word from today's sponsors.
This week's podcast is brought to you by 1-800-Flowers. Are you starting to see more and more Valentine's displays at malls and grocery stores? Are you starting to get that Valentine's Day creep? It may feel a little bit early to you, but there are advantages to taking care of your Valentine's Day needs today. Right now, there is a flash sale at 1-800-Flowers.com. Right now, you can score up to 60% off of best-selling bouquets, arrangements, and gifts. That's right, 60% off selected items that are guaranteed to wow the person who receives them. There's an amazing selection of sweets, treats, and bouquets. 1-800-Flowers has everything you need for Valentine's Day. 1-800-Flowers works with premier farms around the world to ensure that you get the best flowers available for the best price possible. Up to 60% off best-selling bouquets and gifts is the perfect reward for thinking ahead and ordering early. Be that person who thinks ahead for once. Order early. Just pick your delivery date and let 1-800-Flowers do the rest. Go to 1-800-Flowers.com to order beautiful Valentine's bouquets, arrangements, and gifts for up to 60% off. Go to 1-800-Flowers.com, click the radio icon, and enter the promo code POLITICS. Order today and save. 1-800-Flowers.com, promo code POLITICS. This week's podcast is also brought to you by WordPress. Every day, millions of people go online and search for local businesses. But does your small business show up? When you create a website on WordPress.com, you make it easier for your customers to find you, to connect with you. And that's what we're looking for, to connect with someone in this world. But also for your business, it's important to find customers. In order to do that, your business needs an online home. It needs a WordPress.com website. You don't need experience setting up a site. WordPress guides you through the entire process from start to finish. They take care of all of the technical stuff. You just need to focus on getting your site up and running. Their customer support team is made up of experts eager to help you to get the most from your site. They're available to help 24 hours a day, Monday through Friday and weekends. That's 7 days a week. Plans start at just $4 a month, and all WordPress plans include a custom domain name for the life of the plan. Come see why 28% of all websites run on WordPress. That's an enormous number. 28% of all websites run on WordPress. Find out why. Get started today with 15% off any new plan purchase. Go to wordpress.com/politics to create your own website. Find a plan that's right for you. Again, that's wordpress.com/politics for 15% off. wordpress.com/politics. Speaking of politics, back to the show.
Okay, and we're back. Our second big question for today, has Trump remade the Republican Party? So this is from an Axios article published on Monday. Quote, rarely has a president changed his party as fast and profoundly as Donald J. Trump. Love him or hate him, you can no longer argue his ability to bend an entire party to his will. In the 2.5 years since he announced his candidacy, he has moved the party away from decades of orthodoxy on trade, Russia, deficits, and more, and has helped make the Law and Order Party skeptical of FBI leadership, end quote. Joining us to talk about this is Julia Zari, 538 contributor and political science professor at Marquette University. Welcome, Julia.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Say hi to Julia, guys.
Hey, Julia.
What's up?
Hello.
So, Julia, to start, before we get to whether this kind of Axios description is right, how does party orthodoxy tend to change? Are there like examples in U.S. political history of ideological inflection points in party politics?
Yeah, there's a big debate about those. It kind of depends on who you ask. So there's two things to be emphasized about that. And one of them is social movements or movements of activists within parties. So usually you can kind of trace when a president comes to office and you see a kind of party shift during that president's time in office, but usually that didn't come out of nowhere. That's preceded by activist movements within the party and also sometimes people who are organized around an interest they're passionate about that are exerting pressure on the government from outside a party. That's one part. And then I guess the other thing I would suggest is like we usually see parties' orthodoxy change when their underlying coalition changes. Obviously, that's kind of related to part one. And like the big example of that is the South leaving the Democratic Party. That made for a major political shift. And that's one of the things to, is it too early to plug stuff that I've written?
No, plug away.
The piece that I wrote, okay, sweet. The piece that I wrote prior to the election last year about how 2016 might bring a recalibration but not a realignment kind of makes me think of that. I think you have seen some of the priorities change in the Republican Party, but without a really big underlying shift in their basic voting coalition.
And who their voters are. Yeah. So when was the last time, like, the parties changed? I mean, you mentioned the South leaving the Democratic Party. Is that the most recent shift for Democrats? And what about Republicans?
Okay, so I had a weird fight with myself in my head about this before you called, and maybe I shouldn't admit that. So I was trying to decide whether Bill Clinton changed the Democratic Party or the Democratic Leadership Council and this kind of shift to the center in the 80s and 90s, and then whether Obama kind of shifted it back. I don't have a definitive answer to that, but I think those are candidates for that question, is that we do see some kind of back and forth on the Democratic side as well. And so one question is, what constitutes a wholesale change in a party's fundamental ideology or orthodoxy? People love this word orthodoxy now. I don't know why.
It's a fun word. Where would you guys peg the kind of last big party change for each party?
Well, with Clinton, Harry always makes his point. Clinton was the last Democrat to win certain, like, southern states.
Sure. I mean, he was the last to win Arkansas, Louisiana, Tennessee. You know, we can go on and on and on. Georgia, actually. Missouri, West Virginia, Kentucky.
But Julia's right that the Clinton shift to the center and the whatever the DNC leadership thing, it feels like a little just below a major party.
Yeah, I would say that the last major shift occurred probably in the 60s and 70s in the way that I think we generally talk about it, right? If you look at the 76 electoral map, looks kind of like the 1961. And then basically the ones after 1980 start to look considerably more like the ones that we have generally.
Like the modern maps.
The modern maps. And there's obviously been some shifts, right? We've seen consistently in Trump's approval rating so far that he continues to have a higher approval rating in the Midwest than he does nationally, which perhaps is a little unusual given the historic trends in that region. But overall, I would say the last major shift was probably in the 60s and 70s.
And that's true for Republicans too, Julia?
So, I mean, I think a little after. I don't know. I feel like I could probably argue with Harry about this all day, but I think there was a lot of debate back and forth in the Republican Party actually between 1976 and 1980 over what we would now call the social issues, the Equal Rights Amendment, and on the abortion issue. There was a lot of infighting in the Republican Party then. So Ronald Reagan winning the nomination in 1980 and then winning the presidency was an indicator of what was going on in the Republican Party. And I think the picture on the Democratic side is a little more complicated.
Okay, that's perfect. That leads us into the modern GOP and Trump. So do you guys all buy that Axios description?
No.
Let me give you the first part again. Rarely has a president changed his party as fast and profoundly as Donald J. Trump. Love him or hate him, you can no longer argue his ability to bend an entire party to his will.
By the way, no like links or quotes or like evidence.
Hey, look, Claire, come on.
Don't disrespect the audience by showing your work, right? You want to? They only have 2 minutes. They're on the subway, or what? They only have the metro.
Metro down.
Le metro.
Actually, because the metro sucks, probably have like lots of time because it's on fire and stuff.
All right, Nathan, can read long form. Don't buy
content.
This.
I actually think that it's a very intelligent summation of what happened in the Republican primary.
Okay, so you do buy it.
I buy it. A year and a half ago.
I was just about to say that. It's okay.
Yeah.
It's not untrue.
Oh, I think it's, depending on how you look at it, 50% untrue.
I think all the clauses in the sentence are fairly wrong.
All right, go, okay. Julia. Go, Julia. And then Nate will respond.
I'm more sympathetic. Okay.
I mean, I guess that never before has a president so rapidly changed their party. I was kind of like, how about FDR? How about Reagan? And I also think, I just think you can't really know this until a couple of election cycles have taken place. I know that doesn't make for a very satisfying article, but the permanence of this change is not yet totally clear. So those are my two pitches.
Yeah. I think it's more of a, and I believe this, the Axios article makes this point, they talk about a culture shift. And I will say that I do think that Trump has probably changed the culture of Washington in a way not the culture of Washington. He's changed people's attitudes towards government and formalities that have been broken that we've found out were sort of important. And I think that there's a certain sense that he's the first president who's captured an activist movement within a party sort of precisely, like this sort of culture war, like, you know, immigration stuff. It seems like a pretty tight capture.
If you want to critique the 402 word or whatever it was article, there's talk about like, oh, how the base is skeptical of trade deals, for example, and globalization. You know, I don't really think that was as big a factor as race and xenophobia and the way that Trump helped to fan those flames a little bit. You know, one of the more important findings of the past year is that racial anxiety seems to correlate better with Trump support than economic anxiety, especially economic anxiety thought of narrowly in terms of things like trade deals or manufacturing jobs, e.g. So, like, you know, I think that's missing from this summation.
All right. So I thought you guys were going to tear this apart a bit more. Let me do it real quick. No, okay. You go, Harry.
I was just going to say a lot of the things that, you know, always remade the image, blah, 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 blah. But a lot of these things, if you look at the polling, were already shifted by the time he got into it. What I would argue is that Donald Trump isn't a cause of many of the things that we've seen shifted within the Republican electorate. He's merely a symptom of it. Immigration had become a huge thing. Remember, Bush couldn't pass a comprehensive immigration reform during his second term, and we saw, obviously, John McCain build the damn wall or get it done or whatever the hell it was during his 2010 Republican primary. And there's a reason why Donald Trump was able to win the nomination, and that was because, besides just getting so much airtime, it was because he found an electorate that was willing to adhere or at least hear him out on certain issues.
We're basically taking kind of umbrage with the timing of it, right? Like, this feels like a year and a half later than when the change actually happened, right? Which is, we're saying, last summer.
And the fact that policies that have been enacted have not been very...
I want to talk about that.
That's what I mean by the culture. But, like, it's a culture change.
Julia, before we get back, I think this is wrong, Julia, on several fronts. I think, as you point out, it sort of like blithely waves away all of history, right? And doesn't kind of do any work to compare Trump's effect to FDR's effect. I think, as Harry points out, there's a symptom cause problem here where a lot of what they credit or blame, depending on your point of view, to Trump, he is maybe a more of a symptom of than a cause. And third, there's this question that Nate just got to, which is like everything that's come out of Congress has been standard GOP fare. So how do you define what a party stands for, Julie? Is it what Congress is doing? Is it what its president says? Is it what its voters believe?
I mean, I think it's all of those. That's one of the first things that we teach on the first day of party politics class is there's the three-part definition of parties, the electorate, the organization, the elected officials, and then, of course, president, Congress, state-level officials can be different. We're actually kind of used to, in this era, them being similar, and I think that's been, like, one of the things we've seen in the Trump era more than the first, like, say, 6 years or 5.5 years of the Bush presidency is all the fissures in the Republican Party. Now that Trump is president with a more conventional Republican Congress, we kind of see all that going down. But I think you're right that the legislative priorities have been standard. And so the question going forward isn't so much how much has the Republican Party changed, but is there a way to reconcile all of these different moving parts? And can you make the kind of low-tax Republican Party also a Republican Party that has this skepticism toward trade? And I want to say something about trade that is a hypothesis. I'm not entirely sure it's true. But it seems to me that when Trump talked about trade on the campaign trail, it was very focused on the specific flawed nature of Obama's trade deals. And it fit into this narrative about Obama as someone who was not looking out for American interests that was quite common with Obama critics. And so that is an interesting kind of dodge of the fundamental philosophical question about how to do international trade or how to globalize the economy. It kind of fits it into this more nationalist narrative. And so that leaves room, I think, to reconcile those positions with a more conventional Republican view on economic issues.
We're applying a political science structure to this Axios article, which I think is like our job, but I also think we're taking, what is the line? We're taking Axios literally when we should just be taking them seriously. Like, I think
really, though?
So the first line of the article, love him or hate him, you can no longer argue his ability to bend an entire party to his will. I will extrapolate from that the point that I think Trump has changed the messaging of the Republican Party in a pretty profound way. I think the constant drumbeating about immigration as a unsubtle dog whistle for race, and, you know, you can use like the MS-13 law and order stuff as an outgrowth of that. I do actually think that's very different in the overt way that the people in the party now feel they can address those issues, and it leads to different kinds of candidates on a state level running different kinds of campaigns.
I'm not sure, by the way, that I agree with Harry's point that Trump is entirely...
Not just entirely, but I think mostly, yes. Did I say entirely? I meant mostly.
Mostly what?
That Trump is entirely... No, that I think Trump can be a cause in some respects. I mean, he has been at the center of political conversation now for 2.5 years in some way, since the summer of 2015. The way that voters group into parties is a little bit arbitrary. There's no particular, like, one rational solution where oh, here's a party coalition that has this set of issues and here's one that has those. It's partly tribal. It's partly cultural. And so the fact that Trump was the guy standing in that opportune position, A, you know, he had the ability to take advantage of it in a variety of ways, including the fact that he had very good skills to maintain media attention and make him the focal point when that was a very valuable tactical strategy in the first half of the GOP primary. And number two, the fact that he kind of won the sweepstakes, so to speak, will affect future history. I mean, the fact that the Philadelphia Eagles won and not the Patriots will affect the way NFL teams manage themselves for years to come, right? Mikey, you look skeptical. Trump is the Nick Foles.
Okay.
I think
that take got bad. But the point is that, like, I actually think I think empirically minded people sometimes go too far out of their way to not reflect the fact that, you know, individual people, when they're presidents, can make a difference.
I would point this out. I do think that Donald Trump did make some changes on some issues, such as even, you know, at least the Republican voters don't view Putin as negatively as they once did. Issues that aren't necessarily at the forefront of the mind, you know, whereby there's no reason if you want to build a wall that you should necessarily love or dislove Vladimir Putin. When those issues became polarized, I think that certainly shifted Republicans into a more pro-Putin camp. But overall, I think that perhaps Donald Trump is taking advantage and perhaps exacerbating some underlying trends that were occurring, but I don't think he created a groundswell as much as perhaps exaggerated. That's what I would say.
Yeah, Julie, I want to end this segment kind of honing in a little more on where there's tension within the party. But there's a difference between cause and catalyst, right? Like, it seems like Trump has exacerbated some of these things, but not necessarily caused them. Are there areas where you feel like the GOP has to reconcile itself in some ways? Are there particular areas where Republicans have tried to hem in Trump that suggests those are kind of the non-negotiable tenets of the party?
So this is another thing I've been thinking a lot about. I think during that, so I want to kind of touch on the Bush years quickly first, which is that I think during the time when George W. Bush was president, there was this kind of conventional wisdom, at least among, you know, people who overthink these kinds of things, that the economic and the socially conservative wings of the party were the ones that were going to be irreconcilable on kind of libertarian grounds. If you believe in smaller government, then you can't possibly be a social conservative, and that's where the explosion would occur. And people were looking for that and not looking for what I think has become the flashpoint. I think as Claire said, I forget the phrase you used, Claire, but I was thinking of it as sort of a political style. And related to that kind of attitude about the rule of law and what I just read an article somewhere about neutral institutions, the attitude about information, particularly information coming out of government agencies. So that's, I think, a place where they're going to have to come to some kind of reconciliation on those issues, because that's a bad thing it's a sort of epistemological thing for a party to fight about. And then immigration, and whether if there's this wing of the party, and this wing existed under George W. Bush and was instrumental in blocking immigration reform then, is the wing that really can't get their mind around some of the compromises that other actors in the process have demanded in terms of figuring out, for example, a path to legalization or citizenship for people in the country without documents. So I think those are the three areas that will have to be reconciled, and I think there's been a lot of time spent by analysts of the Republican Party looking at the wrong thing.
So, Claire, do you think the party can reconcile itself in those areas? And let me add one more, which is to say, like, the Axios article focused so much on policy, which mm-hmm. is, I think, the area where Trump has had the least effect basically, yeah. as opposed to, I mean, if you told me that, you know, Trump has remade the GOP on kind of reverence for small d Democratic norms, I'd listen to that argument.
Right. It's like this weird undercutting that it's like, oh, it's all important things happen on a policy basis. But people vote based on the politics, the thing that a lot of people in D.C. journalism or, you know, our brand of journalism see as frippery. But in fact, like, you know, whatever. People vote based on, like, their political hormones.
No, they start with the candidate and work backwards. I mean, we saw that on Trade.
Yeah, the stuff where, like, people will cite examples saying when public opinion shifts on something, maybe the FBI, for example, as a result of a partisan leader or a party kind of changing opinion. Like, again, that's not news at this point. It's really important, and partisanship's a very important thing to understand if you're understanding American politics. But, like, people kind of express a little bit too much shock and outrage where, yeah, people are really partisan and you know, I don't know. I guess I'm thinking out loud.
Can you reconcile it, right? That was the original question. Like, will the party ever be able to reconcile what we're sort of shuffling around and talking about as this shift that's happened under Trump?
Yeah. I guess I have a question for Julia, or maybe for the group.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Is partisanship still increasing in the Trump era?
That's a question for numbers, right? But, I mean, I suspect that this sharp increase in partisanship was under Obama. And I can tell you the numbers that I know, which is actually the notable shift is around the Iraq War. Impact of partisanship on vote choice and on presidential approval happened while Bush was in his first term. So, you know, I also think that the sort of racial symbolism behind polarization and the association of the president with a strong kind of party brand that's heavily racialized, and that's obviously an Obama effect, and Trump just sort of like rounds it out and gives Democrats something to build their opposition around. So that's my sense of kind of the qualitative dimension, but I'm not entirely sure how that's playing out with the numbers.
Harry.
Yeah, I have not necessarily seen anything to suggest so far that Republicans are moving in one way or another. I will say that it is interesting that perhaps some of the Democrats that seem to be coming to power seem to be a little bit more liberal than those of years past. We've obviously seen, you know, Gillibrand and Harris sort of take up this mantle of being as anti-Trump as possible because that's where they think the base is heading. So I would be interested to see, there's been this long argument in political science circles over the past 10, 15 years that there's a quote-unquote asymmetric polarization, that is that Republicans are the main cause of Democrats and Republicans being further and further apart, ideologically speaking. But I think it would be very interesting to see. I think that there's certainly some evidence, at least during the Trump era, that perhaps it's Democrats are starting to move a little bit more to the left.
I mean, one thing you could argue is that Trump demonstrated that the GOP was more partisan than ideological.
Yes.
Yeah. And so if you kind of flip everything 45 degrees, so some things are what was happening all along and some things weren't, you know, you still have that same gravity toward defending the party on partisan grounds. And maybe the substance is less important, although I think one can argue that Trump actually kind of correctly identified or Trumpism, that, like, actually the real schisms culturally and politically are more along the lines that he discusses, which, by the way, needs to include a foregrounded discussion of race than kind of the Romney versus Obama
right.
differentiation.
All right. Thank you, Julia.
Thank you all for having me.
That is it for today's show. My name is Micah Cohen. Galen Druk is our producer, but he abandoned us this week. So special thanks to Chad Matlin, our features editor, podcast editor, for stepping in. Our politics editor is...
He's our Nick Foles.
Yeah, Chad is our Nick Foles. Tony Chow is in the control room. Harry, once again, thank you for being here. I know you're going on to big things. We'll miss you. listeners for the next few weeks. I'll be filling in. I'm sorry. You can get in touch with us by emailing us at podcast@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store. When you leave a rating, it helps our rankings, which helps other people discover the show. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you soon.